Hi, this is Donna Hudson again, returning with the Decatur Herald and Review for Monday, August 17th, 2026. We continue now with the Nation and World page. The article here is entitled, Iran May Ban Interviews, Bill Meant to Curb Foreign Influence. This article is from Reuters, Dateline Dubai. Iran's parliament approved on Sunday the general principles of a bill that would criminalize interviews and other communications with media deemed hostile to the Islamic Republic, including U.S. or Israeli media and outlets financed by either country, Iran's Sarg newspaper reported. Osman Salari, a member of Parliament's Judicial and Legal Commission, said the individual provisions of the bill, which is aimed at countering foreign intelligence influence, have yet to be debated and approved. Reports about the bill's details should not yet be considered final, Salari told the Mizan news agency. Under the proposed bill, interviews or participation in discussions with such media would be banned, and violations would carry 6 months to 2 years in prison. Interviews with other foreign media would require notification to the intelligence ministry, while contact with foreign embassies, offices of foreign organizations, or other non-Iranian institutions without notification and written permission from the foreign ministry would be punishable by a fine and deprivation of certain social rights. The proposed legislation would also harden penalties for economic crimes committed under the direction or supervision of foreigners, ban providing information to foreigners without intelligence ministry approval, and restrict scientific cooperation with foreign institutions outside an approved list. It would punish policy or legislative proposals made under the direction of foreign intelligence services if they harm Iran's security or independence, with prison terms of up to 30 years. Cases would be heard by revolutionary courts. The bill will be considered article by article in Parliament. Once Parliament approves the final text, it will have to be reviewed by the Guardian Council before becoming law. The move is not the first time Iran has criminalized cooperation with foreign entities. A law passed in 2025 after a 12-day war with Israel imposed tougher penalties for alleged cooperation with hostile states. Iranian photojournalist Yalda Mohiri was sentenced this month to 15 years under that law over allegations that included giving interviews to media deemed hostile and providing photographs to U.S. and Israel-linked organizations. In 2022, she spent 3 months in jail and was sentenced to 8 years in prison for covering the nationwide Woman Life Freedom uprisings that erupted after the death of young Iranian woman Mahsa Amini in police custody. An amnesty later reduced the sentence, but Mohiri said the case continued to expose her to questioning by authorities. Mohiri also said she remained committed to her work despite the prospect of further imprisonment. Reporters Without Borders says 16 journalists have been detained in Iran this year. Our next article is entitled, Quake Death Toll Reaches 290. 1 week later, little hope of finding more survivors. Dateline Bogota. Search teams worked through the rubble of collapsed buildings in western Colombia on Sunday, nearly a week after a powerful earthquake devastated cities and towns across the country's west, killing hundreds and leaving many more missing, injured, or homeless. The 7.4 magnitude quake struck around 7:30 a.m. Monday, August 10th, in San Jose del Palmar, toppling apartment buildings and damaging schools, churches, hospitals, and homes from the Pacific port of Buenaventura to Colombia's coffee-growing region and major western cities, including Cali and Pereira. Official estimates issued on Sunday put the death toll at around 290, with more than 140 people still missing and 4,200 injured. In Cali, Colombia's third largest city, emergency workers continued searching unstable piles of concrete and twisted metal on Sunday as rescue efforts increasingly gave way to the recovery of bodies. Unfortunately, there are no signs of life, Cali Fire Department Captain Alberto Hernandez said. Miracles can happen, but honestly, as a believer and based on what we have seen, there is no indication that anyone is still alive. Aftershocks have added to the danger for crews working in damaged neighborhoods and for residents still unable to return home. Work has to be done very carefully and methodically, so we do not put rescuers or community members helping at the site at further risk, Hernandez added. In Pereira, hundreds of people spent the night on mats or in tents at a makeshift shelter in a park where coordinators said there was a lack of blankets, tents, hygiene products, and food. Horrible. It's overwhelming, said Claudia Galliano, 53, who lost her home in Pereira. Her father, Arnulfo Galliano, was pulled alive from the rubble, but later died in a hospital. The earthquake took my father from me, but there are people worse off than me left on the street without family, without anything. Daniela Largo, 32, died in a hospital after surviving 36 hours under the rubble, and 24-year-old Juan Felipe Giraldo was found dead after an intense operation at a collapsed hotel. Giraldo, whose father spent days by the collapsed building waiting for news, had been set to get married on Sunday. He leaves behind a 2-year-old son. As hopes of finding more survivors dimmed, the relief operation was expanding. In Bogota, a stadium was turned into a donation collection center, while in Pereira, authorities were treating injured pets and distributing donated animal food. The quake is the first major crisis facing President Abelardo de la Espriella, who took office just days before the disaster and now faces the task of overseeing relief and reconstruction. De la Espriella said Sunday that Colombian billionaire banker Jaime Galinsky, who also controls food company Nutresa, would donate $47.75 million to rebuild hospitals and schools in Galinsky's hometown of Cali. The Santo Domingo family, which controls a vast media empire in the nation, pledged $32 million on Friday. Our next article on the Nation World page is entitled, Pope Urges End to Violence in West Bank. This article is from Reuters. Dateline Castel Gandolfo, Italy. Pope Leo called on Sunday for an end to violence against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank amid a surge of attacks by militant settlers and a siege in the territory's village of Kusra. Israeli settlers encircled houses after cutting off water and electricity in what rights groups have said is an effort to seize more land where Palestinians aim to establish a state. I renew my appeal for an end to the repeated violence against the Palestinian civilian population in the West Bank, the Pope said. I urgently ask the international community to take action so as to advance the two-state solution for a fair and lasting peace. The Vatican has long backed the idea of a Palestinian state, which has been recognized by more than 150 of 193 UN member states as encompassing the Gaza Strip and West Bank. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing coalition government has overseen settlement construction in the West Bank that Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich says is aimed at burying the idea of such a state. Meanwhile, U.S. leaders met with Egyptian, Qatari, and Turkish mediators on Sunday in Cairo, aiming to advance Trump's Gaza peace plan, a diplomatic source said. Hamas officials were present at some of the meetings held with President Donald Trump's envoy and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and Trump's Board of Peace envoy for Gaza, Nikolay Mladenov. The two were scheduled to meet with Netanyahu on Monday. And we'll finish out the Nation and World page with several digest articles from Wire Reports. Over 1,000 lose power in Hawaii. Almost 130,000 utility customers in Hawaii had no power Sunday morning after Hurricane Lala brushed the Big Island before being downgraded to a tropical storm. Hawaiian Electric warned customers that repair efforts were hampered by hurricane-force winds and rain, flooded roadways, and downed trees. Lala's maximum sustained winds of 70 miles per hour remained just below hurricane status, and weather officials continued to warn of life-threatening conditions. As of Sunday, one person was reported dead in a car-related incident, and two homes were swept away. 12 killed in bus crash in Hungary. A dozen people were killed and at least 10 seriously injured after a Polish bus carrying 57 pilgrims veered off a motorway in eastern Hungary. Hungarian Prime Minister Peter Magyar said Sunday that the bus ran into a ditch and tipped over at about 1 a.m. The bus, which also had two drivers on board, was returning to Poland from a shrine to the Virgin Mary at Medjugorje in southeastern Bosnia. In July 2002, a bus carrying Polish pilgrims flipped over in western Hungary, killing 20 people. Taliban. The Taliban marked 5 years in power on Saturday, seeking to portray their government as in control, even as aid and rights groups warned of escalating crises. Outside the former U.S. embassy in Kabul, armored Taliban vehicles took part in a parade, displaying flags and banners and celebrating what the government described as Victory Day from Western domination. Execution. Iran on Sunday executed a man convicted of deliberately driving his car into police officers during anti-government protests, Iran's semi-official Tasnim news agency reported. Sharam Sadeghi was accused of driving a car into police officers in Karaj on January 8th, injuring 7 officers, one of whom was left in a coma for 3 months, according to Tasnim. Authorities described Sadeghi's actions as in favor of Israel, the U.S., and hostile groups under Iran's espionage law. Theft. 4 artworks by 15th-century painter Antonello da Messina were stolen late Saturday night from a museum in his Sicilian hometown. The thieves entered the Museo Regionale di Messina while the town was celebrating Assumption Day, Messina Mayor Federico Basile told Reuters. The thieves stole 5 wooden panels but abandoned 2 outside the museum and took a 4th artwork from a display case. Wildfire. Firefighters battled on Sunday to contain a Belgian wildfire that has burned 3,000 hectares of land and which local authorities said was heading toward the German border. The blaze in the High Fens, a nature reserve in East Belgium, has been burning since Friday and is the country's largest wildfire on record. Shooting. Virginia authorities have a suspect in custody charged with an early Saturday shooting that left 5 people injured on the campus of Virginia State University. Chesterfield County Police said late Saturday that Cameron Harris, 19, of Henrico County, Virginia, was found hiding in a closet inside a campus dormitory. He is not a student at VSU, authorities said. Boat accident. Zimbabwe's National Police Service said in a post on X on Sunday that the death toll from a boat accident on Lake Kariba on Tuesday rose to 80 after 8 more bodies were found. Investigations suggested the boat was overloaded when it went over during high winds. We turn now to the business section with an article entitled, For Your Amusement, Behind the Scenes with Fan Favorite Whirling and Plunging Carnival Rides. This article was written by Jim Beckerman of the Bergen, New Jersey Record. Carnival operators look at rides a little differently from the rest of us. For the public, the question is, which one do we go on first? For the professionals, the question is, which one is the biggest pain to transport and assemble? It's a tough industry, said Ron Gustafson, an amusement industry historian and author and former Hall of Fame chairman of the International Association of Amusement Parks and Attractions. These rides aren't cheap, he said. There's maintenance, upkeep, employees, cost of fuel, insurance, fees, and there's also the cost in time. It's 60 to 80 hours a week in season, he said. It's not for everyone. The people who get into this business do it because they love it and because the public loves it. There's nothing like going to an amusement park or fair, Gustafson said. The smells, the noises, the screams of the kids on the rides, the getting a little sunburned and having fun, I don't think that will ever change. Neither do the rides. The same ones tend to reappear over and over at county fairs and carnivals, not to mention boardwalks and amusement parks. Here are some favorites and what the professionals think of them. The Himalaya. This ride, which courses over an undulating track, dates back to the 1950s. but its origin is older. Switchbacks and scenic railways were a feature of British fairgrounds in the early 1900s. A closer ancestor was the caterpillar, introduced in 1922. A canvas canopy descended on the cars. When it came up at the end of the ride, couples could be discovered smooching. In the 1920s, this was considered hilarious. There's still one operating in Salem, New Hampshire, Gustafson said. The Himalaya, made by Wyndham Rides, also resembles several older attractions, including Music Express by Majestic Manufacturing, and, with variations, the Flying Bobs and the Thunderbolt, both by Chance Rides. The public may barely notice the difference. Some people have to look at the logistics and cost of moving equipment, especially with the cost of fuel being $5 a gallon, Gustafson said. The Himalaya and Music Express are one trailer. The Bobs are two trailer rides. The Pirate Ship. This pendulum-like swing ride, variations made by Chance, Huss, and Zeppola Incorporated, an Italian company with offices in Boonton, New Jersey, is more complicated than it looks. It's kind of a sophisticated mechanism, Gustafson said. For the ship to get to its full height, that takes propulsion. The motor pushes the ship forward, and there's a sensor. When the ship passes the sensor, it tells the motor to change direction. You don't want the ride to go above the tower. Some versions, like Chance's and Zamperla's, are one-truck rides. The Huss version, introduced in 1978, requires three. The Wave Swinger. This ride's ancestor is the Traverse Circle Swing, introduced in 1904 in Coney Island's Luna Park and other places. Later versions were called the Chero Plane and the Yo-Yo. It's a revolving ride with seats suspended from chains, which swing out when the machine picks up speed. The Wave Swinger, made by the German company Zierer and manufactured in 1972, added an additional thrill. As the ride accelerates, it also oscillates. The original Zierer version takes two trailers to move, but other companies make smaller units. There are quite a few in the U.S., Gustafson said, and the Europeans have also embraced smaller versions. The Ferris Wheel. Pleasure wheels were seen in fairgrounds going back to the 18th century, but engineer George Washington Gale Ferris, Jr. built a bigger one. The original giant 264-foot-high wheel for the 1893 World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago. The name eventually became generic. Lots of companies make Ferris wheels. The Eli Bridge Company out of Jacksonville, Illinois, has built them since 1900. The biggest ones, they take as many as 9 trucks to transport, dominate a skyline, and announce to the world that the fair is in town. More typical are smaller wheels, 3, 2, or even 1 trailer jobs. Guests expect it, Gustafson said of Ferris wheels, and with families, everybody will ride it. The carousel. Likewise, a carnival without a carousel is unthinkable. The word means little war. It was the name of a tournament popular in 17th century France with knights on horseback who took turns trying to spear a ring. Eventually, the French developed a mechanical contraption to train its riders, wooden horses on a revolving frame, and the merry-go-round was born. Carousels are going to need at least a full semi and maybe another trailer behind it, Gustafson said, because there's a lot of pieces. There are all the animals and all the poles that support the animals, and some of them have a lot of scenery. There's a lot of piecework and a lot of maintenance. The roller coaster. Miners in what is now Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, found in the early 19th century that tourists would pay 50 cents to ride their gravity-powered downhill railroad meant for transporting coal. But the real father of the roller coaster is usually said to be Lamarcus Thompson, whose switchback railway, launched at Coney Island in 1884, was meant to keep thrill-seeking young men out of saloons. It went 6 miles per hour. Today's roller coasters may seem too big and unwieldy to transport, but where there's a will, there's a way. Small kiddie coasters are one trailer, Gustafson said. The bigger roller coasters you're talking about, 4, 5, 6 trailers. The biggest ones are 9, but there aren't too many of those 9 trailer rides out. The Enterprise and the Endeavor. There are a lot of rides that use the principle of a hydraulic arm to lift a horizontally spinning ride to a tilted or even vertical position. The Roundup, introduced by Frank Rubitz in 1954, is one well-known contraption. Others are the Enterprise, introduced by Huss in 1972, and the Endeavor, launched by Zamperla in 2016. It's a two-trailer operation. It rises up via a hydraulic center, and as it spins, it raises up and the centrifugal force allows you to ride upside down, Gustafson said. The Endeavor is kind of based on the old Enterprise, but it has an open seat, which makes it more enticing to the rider. Dark rides. Dark rides, known as ghost trains in Britain, feature ghosts, skeletons, and other mechanical frights that pop out of walls and drop from the ceiling. They are often called pretzel rides because of the winding, pretzel-like tracks along which the cars meander. The first ones were built in 1928 by the Pretzel Amusement Ride Company of Bridgeton, New Jersey. They take one or two trailers, Gustafson said. They're not as large as the permanent installations in a park, but even though it's not a big, long ride, people love the thrill of the tricks, as we call them, the ghosts jumping out, the things that are triggered electrically as you go through. Now we'll turn to Hints from Heloise, a way to strip out excess hair product. Dear Heloise, get a small plastic rinsing cup, shake baking soda into it, add a little shampoo on top, mix with your finger, then wash your hair with this mixture. It'll strip out excess product. I've done this for years. Joni T. in Little Rock, Arkansas. Lead leaching. Dear Heloise, I have vintage white milk glass nesting bowls, white federal glass bowls, and vintage jadeite bowls. I keep hearing they aren't safe to use anymore due to them containing lead. Can you please advise me regarding this? Also, I'm still using my vintage white frost plates and bowls from the 80s and 90s. I hope these are safe. Nancy K. via email. Nancy, any plate or bowl that was manufactured before 2005 is suspicious. Many contain lead paint in the decorations on the bowl or plate. It's a small amount, but still not advisable to use for any purpose other than decoration. White frost plates and bowls manufactured today are made from non-porous vitriol glass and are safe to use. However, your plates from the 80s or 90s may not be safe to use. Your best option is to have someone test your plates for lead or cadmium content. Heloise. Logging food. Dear Heloise, I'm in my 60s and overweight. I was curious about my food choices, so I found a free app called MyFitnessPal to log the foods I eat daily. It really opened my eyes as to how food affected my weight. I still treat myself to my junk food. However, logging food has helped me with portion control. Slow weight loss was my goal. I didn't gain weight for a short period of time and wanted to find something sustainable. I have used this process for 6 months and lost 17 pounds. Believe that you can be successful with your weight loss journey and it'll happen. Susan W. in River Falls, Wisconsin. Susan, congratulations on your weight loss. You have the right attitude. I've always told myself, in 1 year, I still plan to be alive, so why not stick to my diet so that I'm slimmer in a year? If I weigh the same as I do now, I'll be disappointed in myself for not sticking to my goal. Heloise. Cooking sound off. Dear Heloise, I read the letter about 1 in 4 Americans being unable to cook. The reason for this is due to parents not allowing their children to learn, as most parents don't care that they have to clean up after their children. There are also adults who didn't learn how to cook because they ruined something as a teen and never tried again. Cindy in Ohio. Cindy, we received several letters on this subject, including letters from teens who only use a microwave. Cooking is a survival skill. What the teens complained about was how long it took them to prepare a nice meal and the fact that no one said thank you or they hated the cleanup afterward. Still, a home-cooked meal is a nice skill to have in your back pocket. Heloise. Send a money-saving or time-saving hint to Heloise at heloise.com. And finally, we'll turn to sports. College football. From 1-11 to playoff, 5 unranked teams who could surprise their way into 2026 CFP. This article is by Austin Curtwright of the USA Today Network. The national championship favorites are obvious, with blue blood teams littered across the preseason U.S. LBM coaches poll. But which teams from outside the top 25 have a chance at the college football playoff? Texas Tech is the favorite to repeat as Big 12 champions, but the conference appears to be wide open following the Brandon Sorsby drama, as the Red Raiders will now turn to Will Hammond at quarterback. Coaching changes across the sport could also shake up the 12-team field, with an influx of transfer portal additions at numerous programs. While none of these teams is a projected CFP contender, there are outcomes in contention. Here's a look at five preseason unranked teams who could shock college football and reach the playoff. Oklahoma State has a wide range of outcomes under first-year coach Eric Morris, who takes over a program left by Mike Gundy, the greatest coach in school history. Morris nearly made the CFP last season with North Texas before the Mean Green fell to Tulane in the American Championship game. He also brought along the nation's leading passer in Drew Mestemaker, along with his top weapons in receiver Wyatt Young and running back Caleb Hawkins, the nation's rushing touchdown leader in 2025. The Cowboys' schedule isn't terrible either. Their two toughest games against number 12 Texas Tech and number 2 Oregon are at home, and they round out their conference schedule at West Virginia, Houston, Iowa State, and Arizona State. If Oklahoma State goes 10-2 with losses to Oregon and Texas Tech, it could feasibly earn an at-large bid, even with a conference championship loss. A CFP bid, or even close to it, would be a huge turnaround for an Oklahoma State team coming off a 1-11 finish last season. TCU. Fifth-year coach Sonny Dykes has already taken TCU to the CFP once, having lost to Georgia in the 2023 National Championship game. The Horned Frogs haven't sniffed a CFP run since, although they're coming off back-to-back 9-win seasons, led by former quarterback John Hoover, now at Indiana. Dykes added Harvard transfer Jaden Craig as Hoover's replacement, landing an under-the-radar passer who received some NFL draft buzz last season. TCU could be a sneaky team in a conference lacking top-end teams outside of Texas Tech and BYU. Its schedule is also manageable, playing BYU, West Virginia, Kansas, and Kansas State at home, while facing UCF, Baylor, Arizona, and Texas Tech on the road. UNLV might have the best odds of reaching the CFP of any team on this list, thanks to being the 2026 Mountain West favorite. The Rebels lost to Boise State in the Mountain West title game last season under first-year coach Dan Mullen, the former Mississippi State and Florida head coach. While they lost quarterback Anthony Colandrea to Nebraska, they added former five-star prospect Jackson Arnold, who has struggled as the starter at Oklahoma and Auburn the past two seasons. UNLV was also able to keep standout running back Jaden Thomas, who racked up 1,273 total yards of offense with 13 touchdowns. UNLV faces a non-conference slate that includes Memphis, North Texas, and California, all of whom could be tough cuts. Boise State is now in the Pac-12, so the Rebels not only need to win the Mountain West, but also need to be the highest-ranked non-Power Four conference champion. UNLV's continuity on its coaching staff gives it the leg up on the American's top CFP contenders. Louisville. Louisville started the 2025 season with a 7-1 record that included a win over then number 2 Miami before dropping three of its last four games against Cal, Clemson, and SMU, all three of whom are projected to be among the better teams in the ACC this season. While the Cardinals lost starting quarterback Miller Moss, they returned star running back tandem Isaac Brown and Kaywan Brown, who make up one of the best backfields in college football. Third-year coach Jeff Brown will also turn the offense to Lincoln Kineholz, a former Ohio State reserve quarterback. The Cardinals have one of the easiest conference slates, avoiding Miami, Clemson, Cal, and Virginia Tech. They also have the opportunity at a few resume-boosting non-conference wins against SEC foes Mississippi and Kentucky. Virginia Tech. Virginia Tech made a huge move this offseason by hiring former Penn State coach James Franklin, who was fired midseason by the Nittany Lions despite taking his former program to the CFP semifinals in 2024. Franklin immediately got to work in the transfer portal, adding one of the most talented groups in the conference, led by multiple former Penn State players and recruits. The Hokies will be led by former Penn State quarterback Ethan Grunkemeyer, who passed for 1,339 yards with 8 touchdowns to 4 interceptions last season and 7 starts as a redshirt freshman. Virginia Tech's schedule, unlike Louisville's, is quite tough, with road games against SMU, Clemson, and Miami. It'll likely have to win 2 of those 3 games to have a shot at the conference title game, along with subsequent CFP chances. And that's it for today's Decatur Herald and Review, Monday, August 17th, 2026. This is Donna Hudson wishing you a good day.